I'm Al Randall. This is number 0336, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0336. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, you'll meet journalist Dave Pell, who puts out the excellent daily weekday newsletter, Next Draft.
In its first iteration, it was just a tech newsletter because I'm also in the second half of my day. I'm an angel investor and I work with a lot of internet companies. So I used to send around a newsletter that gave sort of the top 10 or 12 tech news stories of the day. And most of them were just stuff that I thought that people I worked with should be aware of. And it sort of started to spread from there. So at some point I decided to go with all news, and that's when I changed the name of it to Next Draft. And from there I sort of just, it was a similar model. I basically go out and I find the 10 most fascinating news stories of the day.
Anelia Sutton, owner of the online business development company TinyLittleEmpires.com.
Back when I was a single mother, I was taking care of my daughter on my own, and I wanted to try to find a way to be able to stay at home and spend more time with her. And I wasn't ever able to do that until much later, but I kept trying, and I kept looking, and I finally, stumbled upon, in this digital age, owning online real estate, basically. Saved me financially.
Stuart Nullman is in with another edition of Book Banter.
Hi, I'm Stuart Nullman. Book Banter returns to Mayberry and looks at the lives of the alter egos of two of its most famous citizens with Andy and Don. So let's whistle our way to the old fishing hole right here on the Stuff File program.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest Slater. The person who told you this was show number 0336 was Al Randall, legendary semi-retired broadcaster who still keeps hot tea and honey on hand, for when the phone rings. And, by the way, an all-around nice guy who has a really amazing studio at his home. Really state-of-the-art stuff. Thank you very much, Al, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff. Oh, Kim Jong-un scientists claim to have invented an alcohol that won't give you a hangover. The liquor is apparently made from plant extract ginseng, and the sugar is replaced with burnt rice, which supposedly eliminates both bitterness and a hangover, according to North Korean media. And you know how well we can trust North Korean media. Named Koryo Liquor, it has been produced at a company that has spent years refining the drink in the country. That's what the state-controlled Pyongyang Times reports. However, the hangover-free claims have been disputed, with experts claiming that there is no such thing. Andre Abrahamian, director of research for Chosen Exchange, told NK News, "There are some high-quality liquors made in North Korea, though in my experience there is no such thing as hangover-free booze anywhere in the world." He added that he hadn't tried the brand, but associated the drink with medicinal properties and isn't that keen on it as a tasty treat. So, basically, we have another unsubstantiated claim coming out of North Korea. You're probably asking yourself, why would North Korea want to work so hard on a non-hangover booze? But think about it. I mean, I'm a non-drinker, but seriously, if you lived in North Korea, wouldn't you pretty much have to drink? Yeah. Store security at a Walmart in Lecanto, Florida, noticed a woman riding around the store on a motorized shopping cart because she had a half-full bottle of wine. The officer says the woman grabbed a box of sushi, ate a piece, and put the box down, and then did the same thing with a box of cinnamon rolls and a box of mini muffins. She apparently liked the rotisserie chicken, she ate most of that, washing it down with the wine. When Citrus County Sheriff's deputies arrested 20-year-old Jocelyn Elida Lopez, they said they found her with syringes and she admitted to shooting up meth earlier in the day. Well, this brings new meaning to Meals on Wheels, doesn't it? On a related note, I'm beginning to think that a trip to a Florida Walmart might be for some folks like going to an amusement park. It's got to be fun to watch. It really has to be fun to watch. Police in Phoenix, Arizona responded to a call at an apartment of 59-year-old Anitra Braxton, where they discovered an unidentified dead woman on the couch covered with a towel. Officials have not been able to identify the body of the woman who Braxton allegedly admitted to shooting, and Braxton hasn't helped. She will not tell us who the victim is. When we ask what the victim's name is, she gives her own name, said Sergeant Trent Crump from the police department. Braxton allegedly told investigators the body was a shrine from God, and she had shot the woman in the eye for not believing in God. Braxton is currently jailed in lieu of $750,000 bail and is expected to face a first-degree murder charge. Two counts if the police suspect that the woman who was the victim was pregnant. Has anybody also considered a psych evaluation? I mean, just asking, because someone needs a checkup from the neck up. Meanwhile, 28-year-old Chantel Jones of Louisiana was home visiting family in Willimantic, Connecticut, when she made a visit to the Ultraviolet Gentlemen's Club. Jones took umbrage at being asked to pay the cover charge to get inside the strip club, and police say she went out to her car, got a baseball bat, and returned and forced her way into the club. She smashed the joint's cash register with the bat and damaged other property, police say. This type of belligerent behavior is grossly unacceptable and will not be tolerated within the city of Willimantic, a police spokesperson declared. Jones was charged with breach of peace and criminal mischief. Wow, busting up the Ultraviolet Gentlemen's Club. Clearly, Chantel is no gentleman. The Palm Beach County, Florida Sheriff's Office has disciplined 52-year-old communication officer Charles M. Morris after an internal affairs investigation revealed he put emergency calls on hold so he could play video games. Calls were held for as long as 40 minutes and included a shooting and a hit-and-run crash. As punishment, considering he has previous reprimands on his record, Morris was demoted from training officer to dispatcher. So, how come this lack of communication officer is still in a job that requires, you know, communication? Shouldn't he be demoted to file clerk or something? And when her boyfriend posted something on his Facebook wall about her, 21-year-old Autumn Lee Kaufman of Upper Mount Bethel, Pennsylvania, took exception to it. A fight ensued, which culminated in Kaufman allegedly pointing a hunting rifle at him. The unnamed boyfriend grabbed the rifle from her and called 911. Kaufman told Pennsylvania State Police troopers that she and her boyfriend were just joking around, and they both point rifles at each other all the time. Troopers didn't buy that. She was arrested on charges of assault, making terroristic threats, reckless endangerment, and harassment. Clearly, she doesn't know about the unfriend option on Facebook. Clearly. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, we have a couple of Darwin File stories to share with you. The second one's a classic, but I'm getting ahead of myself. Story number one, a 40-year-old man driving a stolen truck was killed after a brief high-speed chase by police on January 14th in Alameda County, California. Police noted that the man had pulled to the side of Highway 238 to flee on foot, but fell to his death off a cliff, landing on the grounds of the San Lorenzo Pioneer Cemetery. Well, at least he won't have to go too far after this, won't he? Yeah. And number two, which I just love, a coroner's hearing in Folkestone, England in January determined that a 16-year-old boy had died of accidental asphyxiation from spray deodorant. According to the boy's mother, he preferred massive application of the spray instead of bathing, and police recovered several dozen empty spray cans in his room. That's right, several dozen empty spray cans in his room. Gee, I wonder if that much deodorant can mask the smell of death decay. Ah, yes, the Darwin file, because as you all know, the tree of life is often self-pruning. Anyway, let's get to our first guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Each and every day, I search high and low, not only for stories to share on the Stuff File program, but guests that I sometimes track down from some of those stories. One of the sources out there is journalist Dave Pell's excellent online newsletter called Next Draft. I thought this would be a good time to get in contact with Dave and share his work with our audience. He's also one half of the What Hurts podcast with journalist and editor Phil Bronstein. Dave is on the line with us right now via Skype from San Francisco. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Good to hear from you.
Good to hear from you, too. Thanks for being on the program with us. So for those who aren't familiar, and I've been talking a blue streak and sending your emails out to everybody in the hopes that they would subscribe to your newsletter, tell us how Next Draft got started and what the idea was in putting it together.
It actually got started in its first iteration. It was just a tech newsletter because I'm also in the second half of my day. I'm an angel investor and I work with a lot of internet companies. So I used to send around a newsletter that gave sort of the top 10 or 12 tech news stories of the day. And most of them were just stuff that I thought the people I worked with should be aware of. And it sort of started to spread from there. And it got pretty big during the first internet boom. But when the first bust happened, I realized, A, I was sort of writing a daily obituary column, and B, I just wasn't really able to tackle a wide variety of interests that I have. Instead, I was just sort of limited by just focusing on tech. So at some point, I decided to go with all news, and that's when I changed the name of it to Next Draft. And from there, I sort of just, it was a similar model. I basically go out and I find the 10 most fascinating news stories of the day. They can be on any topic, and I send them out in a newsletter, and there's also an iOS app for your iPad and iPhone that people can get.
So how do you decide what are the 10 most fascinating stories?
You know, it really is personality driven. It's almost the opposite of a news algorithm. I basically just every morning, about 9 a.m. Pacific time, I open up about 75 news tabs and I just start looking. I don't use any special tools. I just use a web browser and I just start looking for stuff that I find interesting. I also, you know, have people I follow on Twitter and a few friends on Facebook that might suggest stories. And occasionally readers will send stories in as well. But it's mostly, I'd say 95, 99% of the stories I find, I'm just looking for them. I just open tabs, start looking, and find out what strikes me as interesting. When I first started the newsletter, I sort of tried to be exhaustive. And I thought, well, if there's a big story about an embassy closing in Iran, I sort of have to have it because I'm the go-to news source for some people. But back then I had a few too many stories. And when I started to say, let me limit it to stuff that I find fascinating and or that I have something either interesting or funny to say about it. And once I did that, the newsletter sort of started to take off.
Speaking of funny things to say, I love the headlines you give each of the stories. They usually make me laugh and make me want to read the story more just to see what you're talking about.
Oh, thanks a lot. Yeah, puns are one of my few skills, and generally they're not a marketable skill, but I managed to use the newsletter to put them to some use.
I'm a big pun fan myself. Now, one of the things, as I mentioned in the introduction, I often look at these stories, and quite often I find for the purposes of this show that your last item, number 10, which is the bottom of the news, I've actually found guests down there for this program. How do you go about in particular searching or putting in the bottom of the news stories? Because a lot of times they're certainly not as heavy and a little more, say, fluffy than the bigger stories that you put in the first part of the next draft.
Yeah, definitely. The bottom of the news is sort of where I collect stories that are either weird or unusual or funny or ridiculous. And sometimes they're just funny, actually. And that's definitely the most popular section. I think a lot of people sort of scroll down and read that first. Those stories generally get a lot of clicks and people seem to have a lot of fun with them. So they're sort of stories that don't necessarily fit with anything else and aren't necessarily that important. But it actually is a critical part of the newsletter, in my opinion, because I really try to mix in either funny takes that I might have or funny news stories or weird news. A, because I think people really like that stuff. And B, because I think that's the way people actually consume news. They don't generally consume it all heavy news at once and all funny news in another environment. They sort of have a mixture of serious and light topics, whether it be in their social media stream or their Twitter stream or the way that they consume news. So it's actually, it's a playful part of Next Draft, but it's actually a really important part to the whole mix.
I have to give a shout out to a PR person in Toronto by the name of Debbie DeGroot, who I've dealt with in the past and who has helped me book some guests on this program. She was the one that actually put me onto your newsletter in the first place and suggested that I subscribe to it, which I did. And I think one of the very first ones, because it hasn't been that long ago that I subscribed to your newsletter, one of the very first ones is where I found a guest. You found a Vox story about where a guy had written a story about the closing of a video store. And I had contacted him and had him as a guest. And that was the beginning of my relationship, in a way, with your work.
Oh, great. Yeah, that really is an example of some of the stories people really generally love. I think there's sort of on the web these days, I think surprising to most people, there's sort of this long read movement where a lot of people are really finding it easier today to share sort of long feature pieces than it was before the web. We sort of have this vision of the internet age that we're all so distracted and we can't focus on stories and we can't read long journalism. I think the opposite is true, that the internet has made it more seamless to share that kind of stories or those unusual stories, and that people actually do want to sort of turn everything off and just focus on an entertaining story. And that story, like you mentioned, about a guy who you know, was part of a video store that closed during the streaming era, is really something I think everybody of a certain demographic and generation can sort of relate to. So it was a really fun story. And it's one of those stories that would have really been impossible to spread wildly before the internet, even though it was cool writing and an interesting story. And because of the internet and the way we share information now, it actually gets a long, interesting read into more hands. So it's one of the few upsides to the internet age, that actually long-form journalism is more popular than ever. I wouldn't have predicted it, but I'm glad it's happening.
One of the other things I mentioned you do is your half of the podcast, What Hurts, that you do with journalist and editor Phil Bronstein. How did that come about?
Well, Phil, who is the executive chairman of Center for Investigative Reporting, and they also have a new incredible podcast called Reveal, which is almost like a 60 minutes for radio. It's on NPR stations everywhere. He's an old friend of mine, and we sort of hang out quite a bit, and we've been talking for years about doing a podcast, because we've, out here in the Bay Area, we have done a few sort of discussions in public venues that went pretty well, and we sort of have a similar bitter and unhappy sense of humor and view of the world. So we decided to try to do a podcast, and Phil came up with the name What Hurts. So we sort of talk about what hurts in terms of things that irritate us in the media, and also what hurts in terms of our personal lives, whether it's physical aches and pains or something nutty that one of our kids did or said. So it's really just like almost two friends hanging out, having coffee, and we found that it was pretty entertaining when we did that, so we decided to put it into a podcast form. And we're just starting out, but so far it's getting a good reaction, and it's been pretty fun.
I had posted on my Facebook page just this past week the most recent one that you did, and I put the teaser as to what it was talking about. And what I wrote down was Sean Penn's journalistic endeavors, Tooth Fairy, and Jews on Skis.
Yeah, that pretty much, if that's as good a summary as what we do, two middle-aged Jews sort of whining about the news and their personal lives. I think that nails it pretty well. It's pretty playful, but that was a really good example, because Phil is the former editor of the San Francisco Chronicle, and he was the first editor ever to unleash Sean Penn's pen onto the world. So he really had a lot to say. So it's sort of a mixture of playfulness and the silliness I bring to the show, and Phil's sense of humor, but also his deep experience in the world of journalism and covering huge stories and working in war zones. So there's a lot of information, but it's delivered the way it might be if two aging Jews were sitting in a steam room.
And I got to admit, I listened to the Sean Penn part, and, well, I listened to the whole thing, but when I was listening to the Sean Penn part, I had a definite idea of what I thought of Sean Penn and the whole idea of the story that he had done. And I have to admit, I got a different perspective, and I didn't change my opinion completely, but it opened my opinion up a little bit after hearing you two guys talk about it.
Well, that sounds good. That sounds like a good recommendation. Hopefully it was fun to listen to, but if you also altered your opinion slightly, that's even better.
Yeah, and I got to admit, I also laughed out loud hearing your tooth fairy story.
That's good, yes. Any pain from my personal life that can evolve into a laugh for someone else, I guess that's doing some good in the world.
Congratulations on these two entities. Like I say, I only came across them recently. I know there are other people out there who have been fans of yours for a longer period of time, but I want to get the word out there because, like I say, you're doing a lot of fun stuff. I actually look forward every day to seeing that thing show up in my email next draft to take a look at it.
Oh, well, I really appreciate that. Yeah, it's sometimes tough, especially a lot of people get the app, but for the people who, most people get the email, and it is definitely a bit of a challenge to convince somebody that they're going to look forward to an email in this day and age. But when they say they do, that really makes my day. So I appreciate that.
Dave, thank you very much for being on the program with us. Pleasure to have a chance to talk to you.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for having me. Good talking to you.
Journalist Dave Pell, the man behind the online newsletter Next Draft, which I urge you to subscribe to. It comes out on weekdays. He's also half of the What Hurts podcast. Now, you can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0336, and you'll find links to both.
You're listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey. Your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about making money with websites. Plus, Stuart Nullman will be along with another edition of Book Banter. And we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. But right now we have much more in the Stuff File News category on a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a Texas funeral home appears to have a problem hanging on to its bodies. Mission Park Funeral Chapels and Cemeteries in San Antonio is facing two lawsuits over missing bodies. The family of Jose C. Perez, who died in February of 2014, claims in a lawsuit the funeral home couldn't find his body and instead displayed a stranger's corpse dressed in the man's suit and jewelry. Now, according to the suit, staff told the family they did not know where their father's remains were and conducted a 2 to 3 hour search. Maybe he was playing hide and seek, I don't know. His body was eventually found at another funeral home. The family of Julie Mott, on the other hand, who died in August at the age of 25, has also filed lawsuits against Mission Park for misplacing her body. After the memorial service, but before the body was transferred to the crematorium, Mission lost possession of Julie Mott's body, and to this day, in other words, they're still looking for it, have been unable to explain how they lost the body. That's what the lawsuit says, which was filed this month. Police believe her body was likely stolen out of its coffin as it sat in a hallway in the funeral home waiting to be transported to the crematorium. The claims have not been proven in court. Police think someone stole the body? Seriously? What the hell is going on in Texas? Or maybe Julie really isn't dead. Dun, dun, dun! Anyway, moving right along, when Tracy Warwood's son visited her, he noticed something unusual at his dad's house, so he took a picture. Later, when the boy's mother saw the photo of what appeared to be a rocket, she notified the FBI. Police went to Warwood's Tacoma, Washington home and found the rocket on the roof where he had allegedly moved it after his son discovered it. Officers closed off the neighborhood, including a nearby elementary school, and removed the tank-piercing munition. While Warwood said he thought the rocket was a training round, X-rays showed it had all working components, including an explosive payload. When the rocket was destroyed, it pierced a 5-inch steel plate. Court records show that Warwood, who had received an other-than-honorable discharge from the Army, claimed he had received the device as a going-away present. Really? Most people just get a plaque. Yeah. And when 47-year-old Jasper Harrison heard a helicopter orbiting above him in Edgewater, Florida, he knew the gig was up. He called 911 to admit, "I'm the guy they're looking for." He gave the dispatcher his location at a storage unit where he grows marijuana and waited for officers to arrive. But it was a news helicopter, not a police bird, and they weren't looking for him. They were reporting on a nearby news event. Harrison was arrested on charges of cultivating cannabis within 1,000 feet of a school and possession of marijuana with intent to sell. Harrison sounds like the kind of guy who would have benefited by spending more time inside that school. He's not a bright puppy, perhaps a slightly paranoid one, but not a bright one. And we have a couple of stories now in a similar vein, that of clumsy carjackers. These are always fun. Number one, 19-year-old Albert Luna was arrested in Coachella, California in December and charged with swiping the keys while a Federal Express driver was unloading a package. The driver reported that Luna later walked away when he could not figure out how to drive the truck. Bonus, the arrest report noted that during the entire episode, Luna was naked. And number two, 25-year-old Kyle Blair was arrested in Surrey, British Columbia in November when he approached a car at an intersection and attempted to pull the driver out. For one thing, the two men in the car were later described as big burly guys, but more important, they were plainclothes police officers on a stakeout. Oopsie! And we have a couple of stories here that definitely do not come under the headline of Mother of the Year. Story number one. 44-year-old Jennifer Terry was charged with driving her daughter and several other minors around Riverdale, Utah in August to facilitate their tossing eggs at 10 to 20 homes. Some damages were reported, but so far, Terry is the only one charged. Hey, Mom, it was August. Not even Halloween. And number two, 32-year-old Mandy Wells told police that she thought for a minute it was a bad idea, but did it anyway. She invited 10 kids aged 12 to 14 to her home for a party and served beer and marijuana. Wells of Springtown, Texas, said her 14-year-old daughter smokes marijuana because the girl suffers from depression. Really? Go figure with a mom like that. What are the odds, huh? Yeah. Anyway, Fort Worth, Texas firefighters responded to a suspected blaze in January at a grain elevator and encountered smoke on the structure's eighth floor, along with a man juggling flaming batons. No explanation was reported except that the man did not belong there. A department spokesperson said his firefighters put the man's torches out. No explanation was reported? Really? I mean, isn't this something you really need to get to the bottom of? At the very least, ask someone if there's a circus in town. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, in December, animal protection officers in Halland County, Sweden, confiscated two cats that the officers found were being mistreated in a home, coddled by two women as babies in pushchairs and spoon-fed while strapped in high chairs. Both cats had been encouraged to suck on pacifiers, and one woman reportedly allowed the cats to suckle her breast. The public broadcaster, SVT, reported that the cats were removed from the home because they were not being allowed to develop natural animal behavior. Okay. You know, before animal protection could step in, someone had to call them to let them know what was going on. Could you imagine the eye-opening experience that person had when they first discovered what these two gals were doing? I could just see it starting with a very strange afternoon tea and cookies date and de-escalating from there. Yikes. Anyway, let's get to our next guest. Disappointed you didn't win the big lottery last week, that big Powerball in the United States? Anelia Sutton says you shouldn't rely on luck when it comes to your financial future. Anelia says there are better ways to financial freedom, especially in the ever-evolving web world. The next generation of millionaires could be found on the internet, turning websites into global businesses. Anelia is the owner of Tiny Little Empires, an online business development company, and she joins us on the line right now from Maryland. Hi, Anelia.
Hi. Hi, everybody. How's everyone doing?
Fine. Thanks for being on the program with us. You know, one of the old sayings they always tout is that necessity is the mother of invention. So I'm assuming, reading a little bit about you, that this all started because you needed it to start, right?
Right. Exactly, Peter. I, you know, back when I was a single mother, I was taking care of my daughter on my own, and I wanted to try to find a way to, you know, be able to stay at home and spend more time with her. And, you know, working a job, you know, 9 to 5, you know, slogging back and forth, it just became an issue for me because I wanted to be the mom that just would stay at home, but I didn't have the financial wherewithal to do that. So it was very necessary. I started looking for, a way to financially support myself and my daughter. I wasn't ever able to do that until much later, but I kept trying, and I kept looking, and I finally, stumbled upon, in this digital age, owning online real estate basically saved me financially.
Now, I understand you started a blog in 2008 called X Cubicle Girl, and you have since amassed 100 websites, and now you're touting this to others who are hoping to do the same. You have a book, and I should mention your website, tinylittleempires.com. There's a book there that people can get that will help in their journey to the same trip that you took. Tell us a little bit about your book.
Yes, it is called OR. It's sort of derived from the fact that it's, you're planning for goal. The acronym is ORE. And so if you put that together, it spells OR, but it stands for online real estate. And really, in this digital age, everyone can really strike it rich online if they know what they're doing. And the book talks about exactly the steps that I've taken, my background. I give many, many examples of, website owners who are doing things and doing big things. I mean, they're earning what most people make in a year. They make that in a month. And so this was the dream. Now I'm earning a great living, and I'm sharing that information with anyone who's interested. They can download the book for free.
It's interesting that you bring up the OR and you mentioned panning for gold, because that's always an analogy I use when talking to entrepreneurs like yourself. And the reason why I say that is, when back in the day when the gold rush took place, It was common knowledge that while there were a lot of people who were looking for gold, the people who were really making the money were those who were helping people look for gold. You know, Levi Strauss became very rich because they made the jeans that people wore when they went panning for gold. There were people who sold the pickaxes and the shovels who made money. I'm using that analogy because I'm wondering, how different is the situation here?
Oh, it is very different with me. I was on, you know, the shoe was on the other side of the foot too, because I was one of those people searching, looking for some means to an end. I wanted the information, and the information is out there, but it's scattered apart. People sort of own their knowledge and their information. They're very proprietary with it, and they'll sell you just a little bit. They'll give you just a little bit to make you dangerous, but not enough, because they want you to continue coming to them. And I, you know, I felt victim and prey to that sort of behavior too. And I spent, I stopped counting at $50,000 over a period of maybe 4 or 5 years, just kept searching and kept, you know, enrolling in different programs and kept, you know, just looking and searching until I finally started seeing, after all that time and all that money and throughout that entire experience, I started to see a pattern emerge. And then that's how I kind of developed my own recipe, you know, for lack of a better term. And now I provide that service to other people. You know, I show everyone. I'm sort of walking down the unbeaten path. I share all of my information, whereas, you know, people who have done this before me, they don't. They don't do that. They don't open up, you know, the floodgate, so to speak. But I do. I share everything, and I'm right there to support, you know, anyone who's interested in what I have to offer.
Okay, without stealing some of your thunder that's in your book, because the book is online, and again, people can download it at tinylittleempires.com. Give us a little bit, like I say, a few ingredients of that so-called recipe you were talking about. Give us an idea of some of the things people can learn about developing a business online.
Well, the first thing you want to do is find yourself a very good hosting company to host your website. A lot of times people come to me and they're like, oh, well, Amelia, is it okay to start a blog with the free services, with the free blog that they, you know, free, you know, website builders? And that's fine to learn and to sort of hone your writing skills and things like that. But you really want to own your website. And with those free website builders, you don't own it. You can build that for a year, 2 years, 3 years, and that could be wiped away because you're under control of, you know, the website owner. So that's the very first step. That's the major thing that I keep seeing repeated over and over. People start a blog on the free, you know, blog services. And I did, too, because I didn't know any better back then. So that's one of the key components that, I really try to steer people towards. And it's really inexpensive. That's the thing. People don't realize. They think, oh, well, you know, that site is so big. It's so popular. I'll never get there. But you will if you just start. You know, it just takes that first step.
I guess even before that, though, the first step before any of that is to find out what kind of business it is suits you, right?
Yeah, it's best to start writing about things that you know and love. That makes it easy. That makes it like it's not work. So write about something you're passionate about, or something, you know, that you can offer a new take on, or, you know, the whole purpose of blogging began when people just started to, you know, give their thoughts on their families and things like that. So just start with where you are and just write, and the skills will come over time. But with my services that I offer and my training, I basically give away, 4 years of training. I condense it down to 4 months.
Okay, let's use you as an example. You mentioned you were a single mom. You have an MBA with a specialization in human resources management. So that's your background. What were you writing about when you started your blogs?
Back when I was just didn't know anything, didn't know A or B. Really, I was just searching. I just kind of started writing about my family, about myself, about life, about the grind, the daily search, you know, just being a single mom. And that's what I'm recommending, because that's what I knew, that, and that's who I was, and my dreams and my hopes. And, you know, back then I also want, you know, was missing the fact that, or was reminiscing, I guess, on the fact that I used to, you know, want to be a singer. And I was writing about all those things, you know, favorite music, just personal stuff, you know, just nothing fancy, nothing special. And my writing was horrible, but I didn't care. And I just got better and better over time. And that's what I'm recommending. You have to get started.
Okay, so
where you are with what you know.
So after you started the writing, and you say your writing got better, and you could turn this into a business, was there an aha moment? Was there a path which you where you went, you know, one way instead of the other, which made the difference for you? What was the light bulb moment, so to speak, if there was one?
There wasn't necessarily one specific light bulb moment. There were multiple light bulb moments over the span of the 4 years that I spent just in researching. And I had to actually, during that time, I actually had to force myself to stop spending money, because I was digging myself in a hole deeper into debt, because I just was so desperate to find the truth, find out how all these people were making money online and how I could do that. And so what I did was, that was sort of the epiphany that I had. I said, okay, Amelia, no more spending, only research. And it takes a lot more time when you're researching without spending the money, because you know, you want to buy the information that's out there on how to do a Facebook page and how to do a Twitter account and how to do all. I'm happy for the time that I took, because now it made me more knowledgeable, because I had to dig deep, you know, without spending, you know, the money.
And unfortunately, we're just about out of time. I should mention you have clients in the U.S., Australia, England, New Zealand, Scotland, and basically globally. People can find out more information.
Yes.
And more importantly, they can get their hands on that book, which is called Or. And it's a 33-page book that is free for the asking. Download it. You can go to tinylittleempires.com, correct?
Yes, tinylittleempires.com.
Anelia, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to talk with us. It's interesting and vital information you're sharing.
Thank you so much for having me, Peter. I appreciate the time.
Anelia Sutton. Again, her book is called Or, O-R-E, and you can download it for free from her website at tinylittleempires.com. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0336, and you'll find the link. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. A sheriff's deputy in the state of Washington who interrupted a bank robber in the middle of an armed robbery is now being sued by the criminal. Todd Kirkpatrick was a serial bank robber, and as he was fleeing the scene of his latest crime, he pointed his gun at Deputy Dan Scott. The deputy responded by firing two shots that hit the man. Kirkpatrick survived and was eventually convicted of four bank robberies. Today, he's serving a 17-year prison sentence, but that hasn't stopped him from filing a lawsuit against Scott. He claims his medical bills should now be paid by the deputy. Let's be fair, it's tough being a law enforcement officer these days. Not only do they have to put their lives on the line every day, sometimes waging battle with armed criminals, they often have to defend themselves from lawsuits when the criminals don't like the way things have turned out. By the way, Deputy Scott was later named Law Enforcement Officer of the Year by the Washington Council of Police and Sheriffs. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamericatv.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nolman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And Stuart is here once again to take us to a kinder, gentler type of place that really doesn't exist anymore. Unless you have all the DVDs or your mind is still locked in the 60s. Hello, Stuart.
Well, thank you, Barney. Peter, hold on. We're going to be, turning on the old black and white TV as we go da-da-da-da-da-da-da on this edition of Book Banter, because it's about Andy Griffith and Don Knotts. They were more than co-stars on the highly rated and much beloved CBS sitcom The Andy Griffith Show. The two were born and raised in the southern U.S., and during the early years, through the Great Depression, they knew nothing but poverty and hardship. They found their refuge from their difficult upbringings by performing on stage, especially by making people laugh, and they began to develop their respective show business personas that would later stick with them for the remainder of their lives and careers. You know, Griffith as a laid-back, genteel, almost preacher-like father figure, and Knotts as the bug-eyed, overzealous, constantly nervous sidekick who would always define the term fidgety. Now, during the first five seasons of The Andy Griffith Show, its enormous success was mainly due to the ideal chemistry between Andy Taylor and Barney Fife, and how this on-screen friendship echoed the strong friendship they had in real life. And the result was a score of memorable episodes. My favorite was Citizen's Arrest. And making Andy Griffith and Don Knotts one of the most famous duos in TV comedy, alongside such greats as Jackie Gleason and Art Carney in The Honeymooners, and of course, Lucille Ball and Desiree Arnaz in I Love Lucy. However, for the two, life beyond the mythical town limits of Mayberry, North Carolina, was a vast contrast, which was filled with personal issues, artistic and creative jealousies, and plenty of struggles to either break away from or try to recapture the spirit of Mayberry and the show that made them famous. Now, this tale of two distinctive, yet at times quite similar actors turned TV legends is told in fascinating, very fascinating, I have to admit, because it is that good, dual biography called Andy and Don.
Now, when you say dual biography, are they running on parallel roads through the course of the book, or is there one first and then another after? Or are they intertwined? How does that work?
No, it's intertwined, actually. It's not like the first half deals with Andy Griffith and the second half deals with Don Knotts. The stories are intertwined, actually. You know, it shifts from like one person to the other throughout the course of the book, but not, you know what I mean? And that makes it more, I like that format much better, actually. It sort of makes them sort of like they have these certain ties. I mean, it makes them like almost like, you know, brothers in a way. You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like blood ties without actually being blood ties.
Right.
Now, what I liked about this book is how the author, his name is Daniel Devise, he managed to tell the story of Andy Griffith and Don Knotts both separately and collectively without breaking up story, like I just said. Now, basically, when they worked together in the writer's room or on the set of The Griffith Show, Andy and Don were magic, and many of their improvised repartees made their writers and fellow cast members constantly laugh end up in the scripts of many of the show's episodes and were responsible for being some of the most memorable moments on The Andy Griffith Show. Now, however, when they were apart, that's when their ugly sides began to appear. See, by the time Don Knotts left the show in 1965, Griffith began to quickly tire of the show. And if you watch those episodes, which were in color, he just sleepwalked through the last three seasons.
You mean he pulled a Fred McMurray?
Yes.
Yes. For those fans of My Three Sons.
You better believe it. Now, the most ironic thing about this is that when he tried to distance himself from Andy Taylor and Mayberry, practically every future TV project he did, even his successful law drama series Matlock, he tried to make that into another incarnation of The Andy Griffith Show, but even going as far as bringing in several former cast members onto the production of this show. In fact, Don Knotts appeared in 17 episodes of Matlock. Now, for Don Knotts, he suffered throughout his time through endless bouts of insecurity, hypochondria, and alcoholism. And even his career, when he was back on the upswing, especially thanks to his role as Ralph Furley in Three's Company, it almost got derailed by a macular degeneration that deteriorated his retina and limited his ability to read scripts and navigate his way through a TV studio set. So how he managed to get through those episodes of Three's Company for, 5 years, I think was a miracle. But somehow, the one thing that remained unchanged was the strong friendship between Andy and Don. And whenever they worked together on a TV special or an episode of Matlock, the chemistry that produced a lot of comedic gems on the Andy Griffith Show just magically reappeared, just like that. Absolutely. As if they it was like 1960 all over again. So fans of classic TV will certainly enjoy Andy and Dawn. It's an absorbing, bittersweet story of how two distinctive personalities with similar backgrounds join forces to create an enduring classic TV show, which will forever leave Andy Taylor, Barney Fife, and the town of Mayberry a permanent place in the collective conscience of TV viewers past and present.
And the book is?
It's called Andy and Dawn by Daniel Devise, published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $34.
Now, what types of books in the similar vein do you recommend? I'm assuming there isn't one called The Frisky Life of Aunt Bee.
No. More like the catty life of Aunt Bee if you want to write a book about Frances Xavier.
Actually, seriously, there is an Aunt Bee cookbook out there.
Yes, I do have that. It was released a little over 20 years ago, actually.
Yeah, I remember when it came out because I did an interview on that back on the old show back in the day.
Well, yeah, with Jim Clark. He was the one who became an Andy Griffith Show authority. But this book, the book I want to recommend, actually, is a book that's called The Andy Griffith Show. It's by a professor from University of Tennessee, Knoxville. His name is Richard Kelly. This was published in 1981, and it's the first and most authoritative account of the history of the Andy Griffith Show and why this show was so popular, you know, on TV, and also and why it became a pop culture phenomenon. This book has been revised several times and adding more additional information, additional chapters, including an unpublished script from the Griffith Show. And it was thanks to this book and the popularity of it that sort of brought about the revival and interest in the Andy Griffith Show in the 80s, and I think could have precipitated that very popular TV movie Return to Mayberry. Excellent. So this book is it.
Excellent. So again, the book we talk about this week is?
Called Andy and Dawn by Daniel Devise, published by Simon & Schuster, and it's $34.
And how can people find you? I'm guessing that you're not sitting by the pond whistling somewhere.
No, I'm not even in front of Floyd's Barbershop either.
Okay.
But I could go for one of Aunt Bee's pies, but not pickles. But you can find me in the West End Times. No, the Montreal Times, actually. I almost said the Mayberry Times. And you can find me in print or online at www.mtltimes.ca.
Thank you very much, Stuart.
Well, thank you, Barney. I mean, Peter, sorry.
Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter. Here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File.
And we're just about into the home stretch here on this edition of the Stuff File program. We do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way in a few moments' time, but right now, a few more Stuff File news stories to share with you. Here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Jamie, who is 29, and Abby Hort, who is 21, an unemployed couple drawing housing and other government benefits, won a United Kingdom lottery prize in December of 2014 worth about $72,000 and promptly spent it all, including some on silly stuff, Abby admitted, and according to a January press report, are now angry that the government will not immediately reinstate their benefits. Abby said, as lottery winners, she and Jamie deserve to buy some nice stuff and go on holiday, but that now, except for the large screen TV and Jamie's Ralph Lauren clothes, the winnings are gone. Said Jamie, this past Christmas was just, quote, the worst ever. Oh, gee. Let's all play the world's smallest violin for this couple, shall we? Boo-hoo. And here are a couple of stories that definitely can come under the heading of wrong place, wrong time. Number one, neighbors in Enola, Oklahoma complained in December and January about a Union Pacific train that had been parked for weeks while tracks up ahead were under repair. Not only does the train block the traffic intersection, it triggers a ringing of the crossing signal. It's annoying, yeah, said one resident, apparently a master of understatement. And number two, at a ski resort in Western Austria recently, as the ski lift was temporarily stopped to address a problem elsewhere on the lift, one occupied lift basket came to rest directly in front of an industrial-strength artificial snowmaking machine, drenching the two passengers for several minutes in a blizzard. And which, of course, yes, there is internet video that shows just this. You know, if someone doesn't get a free ski season pass out of this, there will be hell to pay, I'm guessing. And following the release of Apple's yearly financials in October and based on sales of its iPhone 6, the company announced that, apart from other assets, it was sitting on $206 billion in cash, which is like owning the entire gross domestic product of Venezuela, but all in cash. Another way of expressing it, using only its cash, Apple could buy every single NFL, NBA, MLB, and NHL team, plus the 20 most valuable international soccer teams, and still have plenty of cash left. Or, as the BGR.com blog also pointed out, it could instead simply give every man, woman, and child in America $646. Coincidentally, about what the new iPhone 6 actually sells for. Yeah, I'll just take the cash, thank you. You know what's frightening? Just think of the amount of money Apple would have if they also had their hands on a phone company. Not only would they be selling the phones, but making a killing on data plans. Now that would be scary. Anyway, we're at the end of the program, which means it's time for one more item, boys and girls. Yes, it's time once again for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the Strange Things Adults Do. This stuff all presents the Idiot of the Day.
27-year-old James Holcomb was arrested in Daytona Beach, Florida, in an alleged gift card theft scheme. Investigators seized 10,442 gift cards as evidence, and Holcomb and his father were charged with racketeering and conspiracy. After he was released on bail, Holcomb was arrested again a short time later. He allegedly tried to sell up to 1,000 gift cards to raise money to pay for his defense attorney. Now, why? Oh, why? When you're on bail for stealing gift cards, would you try to sell stolen gift cards to pay for your lawyer? One reason, and one reason only, you're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0336. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0336. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded in iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.